From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we learn about what's on the ballot for today's spring primary and why it's important to vote in this election.
When we talk about all voting being local, these are local elections that will impact our everyday experience.
For those braving this cold snap, we've got some important reminders about how to stay safe on the ice. Plus, we learn about Punchki traditions, as so many of us enjoy them on this Fat Tuesday.
This is a yeast donut, and it's this yummy, rich, delicious thing. You're using up the last of the temptations before Lent comes, and you eat them all up on the Thursday before Lent or Fat Tuesday, not on the days in between.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we learn about the different mutations of the COVID-19 virus in Wisconsin. We get advice on how to stay safe on the ice during this cold snap. The latest Bubbler Talk explores Milwaukee's history with nuclear weapons. And on this Fat Tuesday, we get a little history of Punchki. We'll start with Election Day. The spring primary is today, and you may not have known that because this election garnered far less attention than the presidential election last year. But the state voting advocacy group, All Voting is Local, believes elections like this are just as important as partisan ones. Among the offices on the ballot are Court of Appeals and Circuit Court judges, school board positions, and State Superintendent of Public Instruction. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with Shantae Nelson, the state director of All Voting is Local. She is encouraging people to remain civically engaged and starts by explaining why it's important to vote in today's election.
This is the election that I believe mostly impacts our everyday lived experience. We have on this election the superintendent of public instruction. We have our courts that's on this ballot. We have some school board seats as well as within the city of or the county of Milwaukee. We have a Milwaukee County board seat as well. These are when we talk about all voting being local. These are local elections that will impact our everyday experience, and that's the thing that I want people to go into this time with, both Tuesday as well as the actual general spring election on the 6th of April.
And let's say we're talking to the Black and Brown community in Milwaukee. Why does State Superintendent of Public Instruction and, you know, various judgeships and school board members, why does that impact the Black and Brown communities?
Well, I'll start with the superintendent for public instruction and school board. These particular seats basically directly impact all decisions that are being made regarding our public schools and who makes those decisions around funding. So the school board, they make a lot of decisions. They have a lot of power as to how public schools are functioning. And then when we talk about funding around our schools, when we talk about standardized testing and things of that nature, that's the superintendent. The superintendent basically sets the tone for what the course of education will look like within Wisconsin, be it private voucher or charter schools, both superintendent as well as school boards need to be held accountable. So just understanding that we have an ability to really position ourselves to determine whether or not Common Core standards are in existence or what those are, as well as the educational curriculum, whether or not that curriculum is culturally responsive.
So what are some basic ways that these positions can affect people's lives, like people on the ground here in the city of Milwaukee?
These particular positions, the school board, the state superintendent can help us to determine what those standardized tests look like. They can determine funding for all three, private, voucher, and charter schools. I should say the superintendent can determine the funding that's set for those particular schools through the budget process, through working with legislatures, through working with the governor. Like I stated, the other things like educational curriculum. the school board as well as the state superintendent has say into what that curriculum is, as well as has say into or in how that curriculum should be taught or how students should be educated through that curriculum, and whether or not the educational process is culturally responsive. We are in a very different space, I think, as a nation. And as a result of, and maybe it's not so different, but it's different in what I've lived or grown up in. And so I think as a result of that, we have to be mindful that we need to find ways to take the way that we educate our students and tie it into our now. We have educated, you know, our students in such a way where we have to find ways to, as parents, to basically communicate with these elected offices in order to give our input as to how we feel like our students should be educated overall. And then if I can just really briefly touch on the judicial branch, this is a branch where historically many people, particularly Black and Brown voters, but I think all around in a lot of ways, both urban as well as suburban areas, you will find pockets where people don't even understand what the judicial branches represent or what how they impact our everyday lived experience or why it is important to engage in these particular voting processes. And so when we think about that, these are nonpartisan elections. And so they don't have the push that maybe a presidential election will have behind it.
What do you say to people who maybe have never been involved in the court system, aren't necessarily in the education system, don't have kids, people that are kind of outside of these spheres of functioning or these institutions? What would you say to them about why this election is important?
I would say it is important because although they themselves have not had to engage in these processes, it is possible that a neighbor has had to engage. And as goes our neighbor, so goes our neighborhood. And so if a neighbor has had to engage in one of these processes, or a family member, or a friend, or maybe just a coworker, in a lot of ways, we are impacted. Even if we are impacted from the standpoint of just being in connection with someone, in Wisconsin specifically, but I'll just say Milwaukee County, but we have a higher rate of individuals who may be facing eviction. And that we may have a person who has never engaged with the courts before, but the courts, they deal with evictions, they deal with speeding tickets, they deal with, it can be drunk driving, it can be anything, right? Where we may have to engage with the law, right? It can be driving, and maybe we ran out the house and we were going maybe to the gym or something to work out, if people, you know, if they're doing that, and maybe you left your ID at home or your proof of insurance at home, right? These are ways that we would still have to engage in some, you know, may, I should say, I don't have to, but may end up having to engage with courts depending on how bad that situation is. And so I would just say, the thing that I've constantly communicated to people is, if you have a neighbor, it is possible that your neighbor has engaged, or your neighbor has a student or something of that nature. If you live, or if you have nieces, nephews, or you live around children in any way, these children are being impacted. And the way that they're impacted through their educational process eventually grows into the way that they handle life and handle life situations as they grow into adulthood.
One of the things you said was that we need to hold these political actors accountable. I was just wondering, as someone who's trying to improve access to voting for people, what's your message to people about staying civically engaged, even when it's not like the big Super Bowl of politics, like the presidential election?
I love that analogy. I would say I often say this around all elected positions. We're dealing with people. And so we can simply, in some ways, contact them and just get to know them. What are they looking at? What are they working on? That may be a way to pique engagement or to pique interest as it relates to engagement. And the other thing that I often say is this: elected officials, particularly in Wisconsin, typically run, when they run for elected office, they run issue-based campaigns. And so because of that, a lot of times they will hone in on particular issues, and maybe those issues don't speak to us, but we have issues concerning their seat that may be close to our heart. And although they may have run on those issues, it creates an opportunity for us to also engage with them and educate them around issues that are close to our heart. And that may be a way to engage in the process. I often say it's an electoral process and not just an election. So we have to find our way to engage with these elected positions where we have a voice within those seats, because they're here to represent us.
Is there anything about this February spring primary that you are working on, concerned about when it comes to access or education or anything like that?
The main thing that we've been doing is lifting up and trying to find creative ways to lift up the fact that it is happening, as well as working with individuals so that they understand how to look up where they go vote and where early voting and things of that nature are. As a coalition, we're always working with the Wisconsin Election Commission to try to find ways to keep their sites updated and put in additional information. We use their site quite a bit. We push a lot of people to that site because it's a trusted site. And so we push a lot of people to that site. And so these are things that we're doing, really educating, as well as making sure that they understand where to go to vote Election Day and what they need.
Well, Shante Nelson of All Voting is Local, thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Shante Nelson is the state director of All Voting is Local, a nonpartisan group with the goal of removing barriers to the ballot box. She spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver about the spring primary taking place today. If you haven't voted yet and you'd like information on today's election, you can find it at WUWM.com, including candidate profiles for all 7 of the state superintendent candidates. Vaccinations have ramped up around the country. A troubling new development could threaten their effectiveness. New variants of this coronavirus have emerged that are more contagious and resistant to the vaccine. Virologist Thomas Friedrich says this is normal for viruses, especially as vaccines make more people immune to the virus. But that doesn't mean people shouldn't be more cautious. Friedrich joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about these new mutations in the coronavirus and what it could mean for the future of this pandemic.
When we talk about a virus mutating and these different variants that we're seeing right now, what are the implications of these mutations? Are they inherently stronger?
No, I think it's really important to keep this in mind. You know, as people who study viruses, we expect them to mutate. And as a matter of fact, as we learn about evolution, we learn that a lot of mutations are actually bad for the virus. They're deleterious. And so viruses that randomly make bad mutations, they may eventually die out. A lot of mutations kind of don't seem to matter for the virus's function one way or another. And as the virus spreads, we expect it to sort of build up an increasing number of mutations that we can use to distinguish viruses that are around today from ones that were around, say, at the start of the pandemic. And so a lot of what we do with these mutations that don't really seem to affect the virus's function is we can use them as genetic fingerprints and use them to track how different variants of the virus are moving around through Wisconsin and the country and the world. However, every once in a while, randomly, some mutation may allow the virus to do something a little bit better, to grow a little faster, to attach to human cells a little bit better. or maybe to evade detection by some part of our immune response. And so those viruses that have such mutations are concerning to us in particular. And that's another reason why we want to track virus evolution, is so that we can detect when and if such variants of concern may arise, and then we can see how they may circulate in the world.
We've been hearing a lot about different variants that have made their way to the U.S., specifically a variant from the U.K., South Africa, and another one from Brazil. When we look at these different variants specifically, are there complications that have come up with them?
Yes. So I should say at first, naming these variants is a real challenge. As scientists, we've learned that we should get away from place names as much as possible, because there can be stigma associated with, you know, having a virus named after your place. That being said, the other ways that we name these viruses are somewhat cumbersome. So the virus that was first detected in the UK doesn't necessarily mean it came from there, but the first detected in the UK is often called B117. So I will call it B117 for the most part. And then there are these two other viruses. There's one that was first detected in South Africa, which is sometimes called B1351 or 501YV2. You can see why we don't like those names either. And then there's this one in Brazil called P2. So I'll just quickly describe each of those and why we're concerned about them. The B117 variant that was detected in the UK first, we have a pretty good sense that that virus is more contagious than other viruses. There has been a little speculation that it may also cause more severe disease than other viruses, but I don't think that's strongly supported by evidence right now. We know that this virus has also been detected in the United States, including two cases in Wisconsin. I think that we can expect that if that virus behaves like it did in the UK and other countries in Europe, that it's going to start to outrace other viruses here in the US also. And that will affect how we think about reopening, especially returning to school, you know, our adherence to masking and social distancing and all of those things. There's another variant that you mentioned that was first detected in South Africa. This virus is sometimes called 501YV2 or B1351. And so this virus is causing concern because it was detected spreading in a place where there had already been a pretty large outbreak in our summer, the Southern Hemisphere's winter. And so they expected people in this area to have a high degree of population immunity, maybe not like herd level immunity to stop the spread, but a lot of people there should already be immune to the virus. And yet new infections are happening at a pretty high rate. That was concerning, that maybe somehow that virus had found a way to evade immune detection a little bit. Similarly, we have some very recent reports from vaccine trials that have been done in South Africa that show lower levels of vaccine effectiveness in South Africa, where this variant is circulating widely, than in other places where they compared, like in the UK. So that is concerning, that current vaccines may be a little less effective against those viruses. And then finally, there's a variant that has been spreading in Brazil that we know the least about. And here again, there was a place in the Amazon region in Brazil, a city called Manaus, which is a pretty large city, that had an enormously high level of infection over the summer. So a lot of people must be immune, and yet they have another large outbreak happening now. And that's caused by a different virus, has slightly different combinations of mutations. But what's particularly concerning is that some of the mutations in this virus that's detected in Brazil are shared by the virus that is detected in South Africa. And so that sort of parallel evolution suggests to us that maybe these viruses are indeed finding ways to mask themselves from the immune response a little bit.
I think that's what's most concerning for people when they hear about these, especially, you know, you were talking about South Africa and the efficacy of vaccines. Something you said led me to believe that these variants also cause more intense symptoms. Is that accurate?
We don't know that. So what is happening is that people who were infected previously in Brazil and South Africa and places where there was a lot of COVID-19 transmission earlier in the year, we're seeing kind of another spike in activity in those places. That doesn't mean that the disease is any more severe, and it's hard to tell what proportion of the people who are being infected now in those places were also infected, say in July and August. But there have been sort of some clear reports of people being infected twice. So one time, let's say in July, and now again with a new variant. And so it could be that that new variant is able to kind of get around that person's immune response. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's causing a more severe disease this time.
Of course, so many Americans still haven't gotten the vaccine, but hearing now that the virus has been able to mutate, at least in some ways, to make the vaccine less effective, that's disconcerting.
It's definitely troublesome. I think that there's a silver lining to that, which is that at least in some information we have, some of the vaccines are able to generate such a strong immune response in most people that we might expect that to overcome the sort of modicum of masking that these variants are able to do for themselves. So this does not mean that vaccines are not effective at all. There was one study that suggested about 70% vaccine effectiveness in a place where these variants were not common, and then about 50% effectiveness in South Africa where they were common. So that doesn't mean that the vaccines don't work at all. And even then, the vaccines were able to protect against hospitalization and death. And so I think, as I believe Dr. Fauci also mentioned, we just may need to revise our expectations a little bit about what the vaccines might do, given the fact that these viral mutants are beginning to circulate.
It reminds me so much of the flu, because as we're talking about this and how the virus is mutating, I'm reminded of the flu vaccine, which, of course, for people who get a flu shot, you get it usually once a year. Is that something that we might expect with COVID-19?
Yes, I think that, we are going to have to just wait and see how this plays out. From the beginning, some scientists have predicted that this is exactly what will happen with COVID-19, that the virus will adapt to humans just like influenza does, and that we may need to update the vaccines from time to time. Does that mean every year or more often or less often? For how long? We don't know. And that seems to be what is happening. So the evolutionary rate of the COVID-19 coronavirus now seems to be at least as fast as sort of the fastest evolving of the seasonal flu viruses. That's not really surprising, though. There's such a huge amount of virus replication happening in the world. There are so many infections still today. And an increasing number of people are becoming immune, either because they've already been infected or because we're starting to roll out vaccines. And that's exactly the situation where, as somebody who studies viral evolution, I would expect the virus to be most likely to adapt. Because what the virus needs to do that is a lot of infections, because each time the virus infects a new person, it kind of gets a chance to make some new mutations. One more pull at the slot machine. And then what we call a selective pressure, which is, some way for natural selection to kind of favor some strains of the virus over others. And so a larger proportion of the human population being immune could apply that pressure and make it so that viruses that are by chance able to hide themselves from the immune system will preferentially transmit and spread. And so we may need to update the vaccines to kind of keep pace with this until we drive virus replication and transmission down to lower levels.
So to some extent, it seems like this could be the virus having a last couple punches in a fight that is hopefully dying down.
I hope that's true. I hope that we don't have the kind of horror movie villain where you think it's dead and it comes back. But I'm afraid that something like that may happen, in the first half of this year. I think the signs in Wisconsin right now are overall pretty good. We're trending in good directions. The number of new infections is going down and associated measures are going down. And it may continue that way for a while. But behind the scenes, These more transmissible viruses and potentially immune escape viruses are beginning to increase in numbers in our country. And so it'll take a while for them to cause a larger number of infections. There are a few different studies trying to kind of project this into the future. And they estimate that by late March, some of these new variants may be causing most coronavirus infections in the US. So we really need to vaccinate as many people as possible between now and then. And the good news about all of this is, you know, the same measures that we have been told about since the beginning of the pandemic still work against these variants. So, you know, masking and hand washing and limiting gatherings and social distancing, all of these things limit the spread of the new variants too.
All right. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Anytime.
Thomas Friedrich is a virologist and professor of pathobiological sciences at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Friedrich spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Many Milwaukeeans have a long-standing tradition of making and eating punschke in celebration of Fat Tuesday. We'll find out more about the history of the beloved donut with contributor Kyle Cherik in about 15 minutes. But first, Bubbler Talk explores the history of Milwaukee's Nike missile sites.
They were generally clustered around very large cities, and they called them rings of supersonic steel because they were the ones that would be guarding as a last line of defense from incoming Soviet bombers that we were fearful were going to use nuclear weapons and blow us up.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
The 1950s are seen as a golden age for the U.S., a time when the country was prosperous and the nuclear family reigned supreme. But the nation had another nuclear obsession, nuclear warfare. The country was embroiled in a war unlike any it had seen before, a Cold War with the nascent Soviet Union, a superpower fighting for its place on the world stage. The U.S. feared a nuclear attack. One solution? Project Nike Ajax, an anti-aircraft missile system surrounding every major U.S. city. Chris Sturdivant, chairman of the Midwest chapter of the Cold War Museum, explains.
They were generally clustered around very large cities like Milwaukee, Chicago, and they called them rings of supersonic steel because they were the ones that would be guarding as a last line of defense from incoming Soviet bombers that we were fearful were going to use nuclear weapons and blow us up.
In 1956, Nike Ajax sites were built around the Milwaukee area. There were eight in total, one in Waukesha, River Hills, Franklin, Lannan, Cudahy, Muskego, and two in Milwaukee itself. You may have seen some of these sites. Although most have been destroyed, some structures still remain, like the ones in Waukesha's Hillcrest Park. Brett Blomberg has been working on restoring a Nike site in Vernon Hills, Illinois, and he describes how it would have worked.
The missiles were stored horizontally underground in roughly a 50 by 60 square foot concrete box underground. A missile would come up to the surface by a hydraulic elevator, one missile at a time, and then the elevator would go down and pick up another missile and bring them up.
Sturdivant continues.
The aim was to intercept the bombers many miles away from the industrial areas in which they were protecting.
So were there really nuclear weapons at these sites? Well, yes. And not quite. Although some of these sites eventually had nuclear warheads, they came later as part of Nike Hercules, the next generation of missiles. Sturdivant explains.
They were the nuclear-fitted, more powerful. The Ajax had a range of 30 miles. Hercules had 90 miles distance to intercept bombers. They could take out multiple Russian bombers, a whole squadron, as opposed to the Ajax was more like a bottle rocket trying to go up there with a conventional warhead.
The Hercules was a much more powerful system, which meant the Army didn't need as many sites to protect the area. So in the early 1960s, most of these sites were closed, leaving just three with nuclear warheads: Waukesha, River Hills, and the most famous site in Milwaukee, now known as the Summerfest Grounds. But they didn't last long. By 1971, every Nike missile site in Milwaukee had closed. There were a number of reasons why. They were expensive to maintain and man. Plus, the arms race was heating up.
Quite frankly, they became irrelevant eventually because the fight started focusing on intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Most of these sites faded into obscurity. And as they did, much of their history died with them. But people like Sturtevant and Blomberg hope to change that. By preserving the site in Vernon Hills, Blomberg hopes to shed some light on this era.
The goal would be to have this open to the public, let them come and look at it, try to explain some of the political thinking about this, of why and where they put them and that kind of thing.
Milwaukee never had to use these missiles, and Sturtevant says that's probably for the best.
The missileers confided that we would be lucky to get 2 to 3 missiles in the air in that point, because if they had penetrated this far, to be able to take out squadrons of Russian incoming Soviet bombers would have been a tall, tall order.
Thankfully, the greatest fears of the Cold War were never realized. And long after the Soviet Union dissolved, the remnants of these missile sites remain, a legacy to the looming threat of nuclear war and the people who ensured it never happened. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sun Badger Solar. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
He knew just what to do. He's duck and cover. Duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You. And you.
And you.
And you.
Duck.
And cover.
Whether we like it or not, ice is an essential part of Wisconsin winters. From fishing to skating, ice can be a great place to have fun in the freezing cold. But it can also be a risky place. Injuries and accidents are commonplace on the ice, and understanding how to mitigate these risks is a necessary part of the experience. Jason Roberts is a recreation warden for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers with his tips on how to be prepared for the worst when enjoying the best things that ice has to offer.
You know, here in Wisconsin and anywhere in the upper Midwest here, we deal with ice, and there's a lot of fun things you can do out on the ice, and can be a whole lot of fun. The challenge always comes into play is whether or not the ice is safe. And to answer your question, is ice ever safe? Inherently, you're standing on water. So no, it's not always safe, and it can't always be safe, but there are certain conditions and there are times in which people can safely recreate. There's always a risk associated with going out onto frozen water. But for the most part, if you use good common sense and you take some precautionary measures, bring along appropriate safety tools, you can be safe out there and have a great time.
Let's look into some of this kind of common sense knowledge. When we're thinking about ice, of course, we're talking about a lot of different types of bodies of water. There's lakes in Wisconsin, there's rivers, there's ponds. Are there any types of water that you really shouldn't walk on?
Sure, yeah. Most people, when they're out recreating, tend to go onto our inland bodies of water, our lakes. And even though lakes are a solid block of water, there are often our inlets and outlets where water moves in and moves out of these lake bodies. Those areas in particular are places you should stay away from. So my recommendation is when it comes to rivers, and it comes to inlets and outlets of inland water bodies, inland lakes, those are areas you should stay away from. Whenever you have water moving underneath ice, it compromises the ice itself and you can have problems. Wherever water levels can change, you get that air gap between the water level and the actual ice, you get buckling, you get cracks in the ice, and that's where things get a little sketchy as far as walking on top of it.
Well, that gets to another question that I have. I grew up on Geneva Lake down in Lake Geneva, and one of the big concerns that we always had was heating and cooling. You know, we'd have like a couple weeks where it got above freezing and then it would go back below and back above. How does that impact the integrity of the ice?
Sure. In the southern part of the state, we get a lot of these warm 40-degree days where on occasion you'll get a bit of rain. There's a couple of common things that you can see and notice about the ice that would give you the sense that maybe you should stay away from it. Seeing water on top of the ice, seeing a different color of ice, like what we call black ice, a darker ice. That's ice that indicates it's getting to the point where the water's level is getting closer to the surface you can see. So as the ice gets darker, the snow starts to disappear, and you see standing water, those are all indications that things can be a little dicey out there. Whenever you have that heating and cooling with the ice, you compromise the safety of that ice because you get an effect. You get a what they call a honeycombing effect with the thawing and refreezing. Whereas you may see or drill down or use a spud bar and see, hey, there's 8 inches of ice. That's plenty to walk on. But once that ice has been compromised with that thawing and refreezing, you get that honeycomb effect, which it may appear to be 8 inches, but in reality, it doesn't have the structural integrity to hold people and especially not recreational vehicles or motor vehicles themselves.
We had a situation down in Lake Geneva that I think became a bit infamous because a number of cars fell into the ice during one of these periods where there was a lot of heating and cooling.
Yeah, that was a comedy of errors in all different aspects out there. If you were down there, and I was down there when that occurred, and the incident you're referring to is when basically they utilized the lake itself, the frozen lake, as a parking lot for their winter fest. And in that scenario, you had cars parked just like a parking lot right off of the landing, the boat landing onto the ice. And whenever you have that much weight in a small area and you have it adjacent to a roadway and a boat ramp where there's runoff, you get salt that washes into the lake from the roadways, you get compromised ice and you get what you saw, which was dozens of vehicles getting submerged in the water.
When we're talking about ice safety, we're also talking about inherently the dangers that ice presents. What are the biggest dangers that can happen when you're on the ice?
The obvious one is certainly falling through, but even beyond that, just slipping and falling is a big issue. One of the top things that wardens get injured, you know, wardens, people going out checking fishing licenses, simply slipping on ice. For that reason, we've implemented a policy where we utilize the creeper system, which is basically a spike that you put on your shoe. You can buy them. Some people used to make them in the old days, but nowadays everyone just straps them on their feet. It's a way of keeping you upright in those slippery conditions. The bigger concern, of course, is what I mentioned, alluded to earlier, which is falling through the ice. And I think if that scenario develops, having the proper gear along with you or having people with you to both help you get out or also if you're alone to self-rescue yourself is really key to staying safe out there. And there are numerous products out there that are available to our recreating public. And it's just a question of whether you want to invest in those life-saving measures. And to me, it's a no-brainer. Many of the ice fishing suits that they make nowadays, the snowmobiling suits that they make nowadays, all have built-in flotation systems. They have some sort of padding that will help keep the person afloat, because that really is key. If you do fall in the water, just be aware that there is going to be that cold shock response. That's just normal. You're going to lose your breath a bit. But if you calm down and give yourself 30 seconds, for the most part, you should be able to get yourself out if, in fact, you're wearing a jacket that provides some flotation. And also, if you have some rescue pegs or rescue sticks, which are basically just these little pegs that you wear around your neck or keep in your pocket. If you're able to get to them, if you fall in the water, you can actually utilize them to pull yourself up onto the ice. Because without them, it's very challenging. It's very difficult. We've ran scenarios where we've gone in with some wetsuits and boy, it's really difficult to get out if you don't have some means of holding on to the ice, which is going to be wet and cold. And these spikes actually allow you to slide up kind of like a sea otter getting on top of the ice.
As we're thinking about the different supplies and the different things that we need to prepare for being on the ice, you mentioned a suit that can be submerged in water and still keep you warm, spikes to help you get out of the ice. What are some other supplies that you should always be carrying with you?
Sure. I'm a big advocate if you're going to be out there on a lake, especially ice fishermen. If you're going to be out there on the lake, to bring a boat seat cushion, which actually is a U.S. Coast Guard approved flotation system. It's a what they call a Type 4. Everyone thinks of it as the square boat cushion that you sit on just to be more comfortable. And I am a big advocate of that. To have that out there, it's much more comfortable to sit in a seat on the bucket with this cushion, but it also provides an important rescue mechanism if in fact you do go in. Keeping yourself from drowning is really the key. And that sounds silly to say, don't drown if you fall through the water. But really, when you fall in the water, you're so set on getting out, when in reality, you have time. You got to focus on your swimming. You got to focus on staying above the water level. And that's really key. And if you have that boat seat cushion, you can stay above water. And hopefully you can either have people there available to you to help you get out, or able to get to your phone and make a call. Another big piece of equipment that you can carry that people don't often think of is a rescue bag. A simple rescue rope that you can throw to somebody is really key to get yourself out, or to get a family member or a fellow fisherman that's out in the ice that happens to fall through. The key is not to become a victim yourself and not rushing to be the hero by jumping in the water to rescue somebody, but rather providing something for them to get themselves out, which is a rope, something they can reach for.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing these tips.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Roberts is a recreation warden for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. It's Fat Tuesday. Have you gotten your punchki yet?
The punchki is take the milk, the eggs, the cream, the butter, the whatever's left over of sweets, of sugars, of fruits, put it into a donut, fry it all up. You're using your oil, and it's this yummy, rich, delicious thing. You're using up the last of the temptations before Lent comes.
We'll learn more about these donuts next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today is Fat Tuesday, and this day combines many festivals and feasting traditions that lead to a period of fasting and reflection. It's also known as Mardi Gras and Shrove Tuesday, and here in Milwaukee, Fat Tuesday is also known as Ponchki Day, thanks to our Polish roots. These Polish donuts are made of a rich yeast dough with various fillings and coatings. Bakeries around the city are selling thousands of them right now. To learn more about ponchki and its history, I'm joined by contributor and culinary historian Kyle Cherik. Kyle, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Hey, thank you, Audrey. And it's so appropriate that I'm talking to a Nowakowski on this pastry holiday.
Yes, on this Holy Fat Tuesday, if we want to call it that.
Of Polish donuts.
Yes. So let's talk about these donuts. What's a ponchki? Ponchki? I'm sure listeners will have many different ways or think of different ways to say it.
Oh, the internet is just full. My research and is firsthand with, I am Polish, half Polish, as you are Polish. My sources tell me it's ponchki, so that's what I'm going to go with. And that's the plural, by the way. So ponche is a singular of it. So if you go and order a ponchki and you only get one, they gypped you. Because you should be getting a lot more than that. But yeah, this really great Fat Tuesday donut that is specific to Polish traditions that goes back to the Middle Ages, which makes sense because that's really about 9th century is when Poland became a Christian country, or, you know, Christianity came in, and a lot of pagan food traditions come out of that whole experience where then they were turned into a form of Christendom. So we have lots of festivals around Christmas where there's the slaughtering the animal, there's the using up the good stuff, the fat pig, that sort of thing. The ponchki is take the milk, the eggs, the cream, the butter, the whatever's left over of sweets, of sugars, of fruits, put it into a donut. It's got to be a yeast donut. This is not a cake donut, ever. This is a yeast donut. Fry it all up. You're using your oil, and it's this yummy, rich, delicious thing. You're using up the last of the temptations before Lent comes, and you eat them all up on the Thursday before Lent or Fat Tuesday, not on the days in between, but on Thursday or Tuesday. And then all of the temptations that might drive you to not be a good Christian during Lent, when you are, you know, subsuming those desires, right? Suppressing those desires and not engaging in those sorts of delicious things. They're gone. They're out of your cupboard. They're out of your larder. You rolled them into a donut. You fried them up. You covered them with anything from fried citrus shavings to glazed sugar to granulated sugar to powdered sugar. Some even do fondant. And then you gobbled them all up with your friends and you said, okay, tomorrow's Ash Wednesday. Here we go.
Yeah, time to get serious. Yeah. And
yeah.
With the ties to Catholicism, basically eating everything sugary, delicious before your fasting of 40 days. Even though it's the Catholic day of celebration, in a town like Milwaukee or anywhere else with strong Polish roots, everyone kind of gets in on the celebration.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we all, especially with this cold snap, we all could use a little, you know, sweetness. And it's, I mean, we're one of the centers on the globe for this, and other towns like Detroit and so forth, any, you know, Pittsburgh, I mean, cities with large Polish populations. Hamtrak, and I hope I'm saying that right, Hamtrak, Michigan, which is just a little, it's kind of an enclave of Detroit, just a little south of the Detroit River, not far from Windsor across the river. They have a national, or excuse me, I guess a citywide Punchki Day, where they have parades, they have Punchki eating contests and races, they have people dressed up as these donuts. I mean, they go deep. But it's, you know, and the history of the donut, I mean, the history of the donut across humankind and eating is really interesting. But the Punchki, which started, there's recipes going back to the Middle Ages, was really twisted up into the form that we know now under August the Third, who was a very famous Polish king. But he, as many aristocracy did, basically imported French chefs. And their move was pastry. And so the improved Punchki, the lighter, fluffier, that sort of thing, glazed Punchki that we now know is really, well, I mean, let's just, the French, they do pastries really well. Just that was the trend at the time. If you were aristocracy and you wanted to be in good form, and he actually, August the Third, was entertained by the Sun King, Louis the XIV, in 1714. And with it, he, you know, left packing with lots and lots of knowledge and recipes and references for French chefs, and the Punchki's never been the same.
Well, this is like a longstanding donut tradition to go all the way back to the Middle Ages. And you mentioned there's various ways to top it. In, you know, say in Milwaukee, I'd say probably the most common is powdered sugar or just granulated sugar all around. But what else sets this apart from your average jelly-filled donut? What kind of fillings are, I mean, I imagine prune is the most traditional route that you're going to go.
Well, actually, the original traditional would be rose hips made into a marmalade.
What are rose hips?
The hips of roses. Very, but if you think about it, very high. People drink rose hip tea because it's very high in vitamin C. It was one of the original, you know, vitamin C sources. So think of it at the time of the year when this is being eaten, everybody could have used another bump of vitamin C. They may not have known about the great nutritious aspects, but this made sense to them. But yeah, you know, strawberry, prunes, raspberries, sweet cheeses, jellies of all sorts. I mean, it's kind of like a game of telephone where, you know, you start here and then it moves forward, moves forward, moves forward, moves forward. The Albertine sisters in Hammond, Indiana have the lock on really like their traditional Punchki because they're a denomination of sisters that are descendant from a Polish saint, Saint Albert. And there's a good number of them that are older. So they have these traditions passed down. The trouble is they have to share their Punchkis with you and you've got to know them. But there are food writers across America that like, it's almost like a pilgrimage to go to Hammond to make friends with these sisters because they don't sell them just to eat these incredibly authentic Punchkis. And I guess that's the move if you're really a donut aficionado. I've got some other things to do and we've got great Punchkis served here at National Bakery or Polonaise or Cranky Al's or, you know, Grebe's, but some people will make the trip.
Sounds like a definitely serious donut aficionado bucket list type thing to do.
Well, it's, yeah. I mean, I have a good friend who is Polish and I wanted the definite, like, how do I pronounce this? And I texted him the other day saying, hey, I just need a little guidance on Polish pronunciation. That's all my text said. And he wrote back Punchki phonetically. And I'm like, okay. We are mano a mano. We see each other.
Yes. You know,
where it's going. But yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's just grandmother comfort, and you bite into it, and it feels right, and it tastes right, and it's the kind of thing that you do a certain time of year, just as you have pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving, and you have strawberry shortcake in the summer. And you know, if you move it into another season, yeah, you can do it, but it's not so much about how delicious it tastes, though it is delicious, but it's got to be right at that time. And that means you're all participating in the ritual together, which is really one of the strongest forces of food in history is ritual. And get some good coffee. That's my advice. We got great coffee in this town. Pair them up, make it a thing.
I agree. Well, thanks, Kyle.
Hey, happy Mardi Gras.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. You can explore his past segments, including a historical look at Thanksgiving meals and the origins of SpaghettiOs, at wuwm.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you missed any of the conversations on today's show, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we speak with Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, the new director of the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment, and learn about his advocacy work. Plus, scammers have been taking advantage of people during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll look at some of the most common scams related to the pandemic, who's been impacted, and how you can avoid being scammed yourself. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.